1. Will this comment help our customers? 2. Will this comment help our company? 3. Will this comment help the person I'm talking to? 4. Will this comment help the person I'm talking about? If the answer is no, the correct strategy does not require a PhD to implement. Don't say it. Habit number 5, starting with no, but, or however. A few years ago, the CEO of a manufacturing company hired me to coach his COO. The COO was talented, but stubborn and opinionated. The first time I met with the COO to go through his direct report's feedback, his reaction was, "But Marshall, I don't do that." "That one is free," I said. "Next time I hear no, but, or however, it's going to cost you $20. "But," he replied, that's $20. "No, I don't," he refuted, "that's $40. "No, no, no," he protested, "that's $60, $80, $100, I said. Within an hour, he was down to $420. It took another 2 hours before he finally understood and said, "Thank you." A year later, I knew the COO was getting better when a woman at the company gave a presentation to top management about how few women were in the company's upper ranks, always an explosive issue that makes men jumpy and defensive. After listening to her fundamental argument, the CEO said, "You're making some very interesting points, but..." The COO stood up and cut his boss off. "Excuse me, I think the correct response is, thank you." The CEO glared at him, then smiled and said, "You're right. Thank you." He turned back to the woman and asked her to continue. When you start a sentence with no, but, however, or any variation thereof, no matter how friendly your tone or how many cute, mollifying phrases you throw in to acknowledge the other person's feelings, the message to the other person is, you are wrong. It's not, I have a different opinion. It's not, perhaps you are misinformed. It's not, I disagree with you. It's bluntly and unequivocally, what you're saying is wrong and what I'm saying is right. Nothing productive can happen after that. The general response from the other person, unless he or she is a saint willing to turn the other cheek, is to dispute your position and fight back. From there, the conversation dissolves into a pointless war. You're no longer communicating. You're both trying to win. There aren't too many cheap, surefire, simple, guaranteed, 100% accurate peeks into the competitive makeup of our colleagues and friends. But the following drill fits the bill. For 1 week, monitor your coworkers' use of no, but, and however. Keep a scorecard of how many times these individuals uses these three words to start a sentence. At the very least, you'll be shocked at how commonly used these words are. If you drill a little deeper, patterns will emerge. You'll see how people inflict these words on others to gain or consolidate power. You'll also see how intensely people resent it, consciously or not, and how it stifles rather than opens up discussion. I monitor my clients' use of no, but, and however instinctively now, the same way an orchestra conductor hears musicians playing sharp or flat. Without even thinking, I keep count on their usage. It's such an important indicator that I do on autopilot. If the numbers pile up in an initial meeting with a client, I'll often interrupt him or her to say, "We've been talking for 40 minutes. Do you realize in that time you have started 17 responses with either no, but, or however?" The client is never aware of it. That's the moment a serious talk about changing behavior begins. If this is your interpersonal challenge, you can do this for yourself just as easily as I do it for my clients. Stop trying to defend your position and start monitoring how many times you begin with no, but, or however. Pay close attention to those moments when you use these words in sentences whose ostensible purpose is agreement with what the other party is saying. For example, "That's true, however," meaning, "You don't think it's true at all." Or the particularly common opener, "Yes, but," meaning, "Prepare to be contradicted." As in almost any one of these exercises to stop annoying behavior, in addition to self-monitoring, it's easy to monetize the solution. Do what I did with the manufacturing COO. Ask a friend or colleague to charge you money every time you say no, but, or however. Once you appreciate how guilty you have been, Maybe then you'll begin to change your winning ways, irony intended. That said, it's still a challenge. A few years ago, I taught a class at a telecom headquarters. One of the men in my class mocked me when I mentioned this problem we have with no, but, and however. He thought it was easy not to use the words. He was so sure of himself that he offered $100 for each time he used them. I made a point of sitting with him during the lunch break. I asked him where he was from, and he replied, Singapore. Singapore, I said, that's a great city. Yeah, he replied, it's great, but... He caught himself and reached into his pocket for cash, saying, I just lost $100, didn't I? That's how pervasive the urge to be right can be. No, but, and however, creep into our conversations, even when the discussion is trivial, even when we should be hyper aware of our word choices, even when it costs us $100. Habit 6. Telling the world how smart we are. This is another variation on our need to win. We need to win people's admiration. We need to let them know that we are at least their intellectual equal, if not their superior. We need to be the smartest person in the room. It usually backfires. Many of us do this covertly and unwittingly all day long. We do it whenever we agree with someone offering us practical advice, whenever we nod our heads impatiently while people are talking, whenever our body language suggests that we are not hearing something we haven't heard before. Are those your drumming fingers, I hear? We do this more overtly when we tell someone, I already knew that. Alternative phrases run the gamut, from the gentle chiding, I think someone told me that, to the sarcastic, I didn't need to hear that, to the downright arrogant, I'm 5 steps ahead of you. The problem here is not that we're merely boasting about how much we know, we're insulting the other person. What we are really saying is, you really don't need to waste my time with that information. You think it's an insight that I haven't heard before, but I agree with you and totally understand what you are saying. You mistake me, the ever so wise and lovely me, for someone who needs to hear what you are saying right now. I am not that person. You are confused. You have no idea how smart I am. Imagine if someone actually said all that to your face. You'd think they were a jackass. But that's what people hear and think when you say, I already knew that. You're better off hearing them out and saying nothing at all. The paradox is that this need to demonstrate how smart we are rarely hits its intended target. A friend was interviewing for a research assistant's job with a psychology professor. The professor was writing a book on genius and creativity. During the course of the interview, the subject turned to great geniuses, specifically Mozart. The professor boasted that he had read everything he could find about Mozart. This is typical academics. They are exceedingly proud of their intellects and never pass up a chance to tell the world how smart they are. But this professor went a step further. To prove his depth of knowledge, he challenged my friend to ask him any question about Mozart. My friend demurred, a little surprised at the strange turn the job interview had taken. But at the same time, his brain was working overtime. Classical music and opera, as luck would have it, were his great passion. He, in fact, knew more than most people about Mozart. Go ahead, said the professor. Don't be shy, I can handle it. My friend begged off again, although by now he was running potential questions through his mind. Where was Mozart born? When did he die? What was his sister's name? All too easy. Indulge me, the professor insisted, unless, of course, you don't know enough to ask a question. The rhetorical slap in the face clinched it for my friend. Okay, he said, name 13 Mozart operas. To a self-proclaimed Mozart fanatic, identifying 13 operas, Mozart composed at least 20 of them, should have been a snap, like asking a presidential historian to name all the vice presidents. Alas, the professor could only name 9. An awkward moment in the interview, thought my friend, feeling both sheepish and triumphant. There was a smart person in the room, but he wasn't the one boasting about it. To the professor's credit, he didn't hold it against my friend. He offered him the job on the spot. To my friend's credit, he declined. Being smart turns people on. Announcing how smart you are turns them off. So how do you tone down the need to tell the world how smart you are? The first step is recognizing our behavior. Have you ever done this? Your assistant dashes into your office with a document that needs your immediate attention. What your assistant doesn't know is that you've already been alerted to the situation a few minutes earlier by another colleague. What do you do? Do you accept the document and thank your assistant, omitting the fact that you are already up to speed on the matter? Or do you find some way to make your assistant aware that you are privy to the information? In my experience, this seemingly insignificant moment is a litmus test for our excessive need to tell people how smart we are. If you can let the moment pass with a simple thank you, you're doing fine. If you're like most people, though, you won't let it go so easily. You'll find a way to communicate that you are a step ahead of your assistant. The manner in which you do so may vary from a simple, "I already knew that," to a dismissive, "Why are you bothering me with this?" But either way, the damage is done. The implication is that your assistant has just wasted your time, that your assistant has confused you with someone who is not up to speed on all things vital and urgent, that your assistant has no clue how smart you really are. Stopping this behavior is not hard. A three-step drill in which you A. pause before opening your mouth to ask yourself, "Is anything I say worth it?" B. conclude that it isn't, and C. say thank you. If you can stop yourself in this minor moment with someone who works closely with you and presumably knows you well, in other words, when nothing is at stake and you don't have to flex your muscles, you have the skill to stop telling the world how smart you are. After all, if you can resist the urge in a really comfortable moment when you are in a dominant position, you will certainly hesitate in other situations when you are not so dominant and comfortable. Think about it. If your CEO walked into your office brandishing the same document, would you tell him or her in the same contemptuous tone that you already knew that? Habit number 7. Speaking when angry. Anger has its value as a management tool, I guess. It wakes up sleepy employees. It raises everyone's metabolism. It delivers the clear message that you give a damn, which employees need to hear on occasion. But at what price? Emotional volatility is not the most reliable leadership tool. When you get angry, you are usually out of control. It's hard to lead people when you've lost control. You may think you have a handle on your temper, that you can use your spontaneous rages to manipulate and motivate people, but it's very hard to predict how people will react to anger. They will shut down as often as they will perk up. Whenever I hear managers justify anger as a management tool, I wonder about all those other leaders who do not need anger to make their subordinates toe the line. Without anger to strike fear in the troops, how do these steady, composed leaders ever get anything accomplished? But the worst thing about anger is how it stifles our ability to change. Once you get a reputation for emotional volatility, you are branded for life. Pretty soon, that is all people know about you. For example, basketball coach Bob Knight won 3 NCAA titles at Indiana University and is only one of 2 coaches in college history with 800 or more victories. By any measure, he's one of the greatest coaches of all time. But he also has a well-documented history of arguing with referees and tossing chairs across the court. That reputation overwhelms Knight's record. When people think of Bob Knight, their first thought is his volcanic temper, not his one lost record. It's the same in the workplace. We save a special place in our mind for our chronically angry colleagues. No matter what else they do, we brand them as easily combustible. When we talk about them, the first words out of people's mouths are, "I hear he has a temper." That hothead image is tough to live down. Given the facts that our efforts to change are judged not by us, but by the people around us, you may need years of calm, collected behavior to shake such a reputation. How do you stop getting angry? I don't have a definitive answer. Anger management is not the subject of this book, and even if it were, I doubt if I could shut down your rages at life's injustices and follies. But I can make you appreciate that A. you're probably not angry at the proverbial other guy, and B, there's a simple way to lose your reputation for getting angry. On the first point, when I have to deal with anger in my line of work, it's invariably one-on-one rage, the anger that one human being induces in another. It's my job to show clients that anger is rarely someone else's fault. It's a flaw that's solely our own. A Buddhist legend tells of a young farmer who was covered with sweat as he paddled his boat up the river. He was going upstream to deliver his produce to the village. He was in a hurry. It was a hot day, and he wanted to make his delivery and get home before dark. As he looked ahead, he spied another vessel, heading rapidly downstream toward his boat. This vessel seemed to be making every effort to hit him. He rowed furiously to get out of the way, but it didn't seem to help. He yelled at the other vessel, "Change direction, you idiot! You were going to hit me! The river is wide, be careful!" His screaming was to no avail. The other vessel hit his boat with a sickening thud. He was enraged as he stood up and cried out to the other vessel, "You moron! How could you manage to hit my boat in the middle of this wide river? What is wrong with you?" As he looked at the other vessel, he realized that there was no one in the other boat. He was screaming at an empty vessel that had broken free of its moorings and was going downstream with the current. The lesson is simple. There is never anyone in the other boat. When we are angry, we are screaming at an empty vessel. All of us have people in our lives who drive us crazy, whom we hate with a passion. We may have spent countless hours reliving the moments when this person was unfair, unappreciative, or inconsiderate to us. Even remembering this person bumps up our blood pressure. It's obvious that the best course of action for dealing with people like this is not to let them make us angry. Getting angry doesn't improve the situation, and life's too short to waste on feeling bad. A sage would say that the person making us so angry cannot help who he is. Getting mad at him for being who he is makes as much sense as getting mad at our desk for being a desk. If we had his parents, his genes, and his background, we would be him. That's easier said than done, but it comes closer to the real issue. More often than not, we might as well be him because we are really angry at ourselves. As to the second point, I can help you lose your reputation as a person who gets angry with one simple piece of advice. It is this. If you keep your mouth shut, no one can ever know how you really feel. That's asking a lot, I know. You have to suppress your natural inclination and bite your tongue. But once you appreciate the payoff of saying nothing, that if you're silent, you cannot make an ass out of yourself or make an enemy out of someone else, then you might have a chance of getting better. I learned this after spending a week at a retreat at a small monastery in Plum Village, France, a few years ago. Our guide was a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, Ich Hat An. Each day, Ich Hat An encouraged us to meditate on a variety of topics. One day, the topic was anger. He asked us to think of a time in our lives when we had become angry and lost control. Then he asked us to analyze who was responsible for our unattractive behavior. I thought of my daughter Kelly when she was in her teens. She came home wearing a huge, brightly colored article of jewelry called a navel ring. These are common among the younger set, along with tattoos in hard-to-reach places of the human anatomy. There's no use having a navel ring if people can't see it. So Kelly had also acquired a heroically skimpy outfit designed to highlight the navel ring and nearly everything else about her abdomen. A navel ring on a daughter is one of those moments that truly tests a father's tolerance and love. But for me, it was a little more complicated, I guess. I reacted with something less than enthusiasm. In fact, I devolved into a raving, ranting caricature of an angry father. As I meditated on this event in the quiet confines of the monastery, I wondered, what was I thinking about? I realized that my first thought was that someone would see my daughter and think, "What a cheap-looking, trashy kid. Who are her parents?" My second thought was worse. What if one of those friends saw her and thought, "I can't believe Marshall allows his kid to parade around town like that." Who was I concerned about in this case? Kelly or me? Was the bigger problem her navel ring or my ego? If I had to do it over again, I would still suggest she lose the navel ring. 1 week of enlightenment in France is good, but not that good. However, I would stop reacting with anger and making a fool out of myself. I may be raging like a lunatic inside, but if I stop speaking when I'm angry, no one has to know about it. The next time you start to speak out of anger, look in the mirror. In every case, you'll find that the root of your rage is not out there, but in here. Habit 8. Negativity. Or, let me explain why that won't work. We all know negative people are what my wife calls negatrons in the workplace. They're the people who are constitutionally incapable of saying something positive or complimentary to any of your suggestions. Negativity is their default response. You could walk into their office with the cure for cancer and the first words out of their mouth would be, "Let me explain why that won't work." That, in my experience, is the telltale phrase of negativity. I cite it as a major annoyance because it's emblematic of our need to share our negative thoughts, even when they haven't been solicited. "Let me explain why that won't work" is not quite the same as adding too much value, because no value is being added. It's not like overusing no, but, and however, because we're not hiding our negativity under the mask of agreement. Nor is it the same as passing judgment on someone else's ideas, because we're not rating or comparing anything. We're not saying it's good, better, or best. It's clearly not the same as making destructive comments, because it's not overtly nasty. "Let me explain why that won't work" is unique because it is pure, unadulterated negativity under the guise of being helpful. We employ it, or variations such as "the only problem with that is," to establish that our expertise or authority is superior to someone else's. It doesn't mean that what we say is correct or useful. It's simply a way of inserting ourselves into a situation as chief arbiter or senior critic. "The only problem with that," to coin a phrase, is how little we like or respect our critics. They're annoying, and over time we treat them as if they're carrying avian flu. We avoid them. We stop working with them. We refuse to help them. I used to know a woman named Terry who ran a lecture bureau in New York City. 2 or 3 times a year, she would book me to speak to a corporate group. I'd talk about leadership and helping people change. At the end of each speech, invariably 1 or 2 people in the audience would come up to me, hand me their cards, and invite me to speak to their group in the near future. Apparently, I was delivering a message that they thought other people would want to hear. I could have handled the details of the speaking appearance myself, I suppose, but because the invitation occurred on a date that Terry had set up for me, I felt obliged to turn it over to her. I thought it was only right that she negotiate for me and earn her commission. I'd call her up immediately after the appearance. She'd ask how the event turned out. Was the host pleased? That sort of thing. I'd say, "Great. In fact, a couple of people want me to speak to their groups." Then I'd read the contact information off their business cards so she could follow up with them. Without fail, Terry's first response was always some variation on, "Let me explain why that won't work." The company had a history of paying low fees, so they couldn't afford me. Message: I was too expensive. The company's employees were yokels who didn't need to hear my message or were too ignorant to get it. Message: I was too sophisticated. The company would abuse my time. They'd want me to stay all day, including dinner, costing me an extra travel day. Message: I'd be overworked. When Terry responded this way, I'd hold the receiver out and stare at it, dumbfounded. Here I was throwing easy money at her, and she was coming up with bogus reasons to shoot me down. Perhaps she thought she was protecting me from a potentially bad deal. But in trying to prove to me that she knew more about her business than I did, she only proved that she didn't understand me at all. I don't overcharge clients. My message is simple, not complicated. And I'm not afraid to work. If my clients want me to stick around all day, I take it as a compliment, not an abuse of my time. It made me wonder if I really wanted Terry presenting me to the world. Eventually, I realized that I could have been forwarding Terry an invitation for me to host the Academy Awards, and she would have found a way to put a negative spin on the opportunity. I stopped working with her. If negativity is your flaw, my first impulse would be to have you monitor your statements the moment someone offers you a helpful suggestion. If you've read this far, you know that I firmly believe that paying attention to what we say is a great indicator of what we're doing to turn people off. If you catch yourself frequently saying, "Let me tell you why that won't work," you know what needs fixing. But in this case, the more revealing clue would be to take a personal inventory of how your colleagues deal with you. How often do they come to you with helpful suggestions, without you having to ask? How often do they knock on your door and sit down to shoot the breeze, or give you a heads up about a development that may affect you? How does the floor traffic around your desk compare with other colleagues? Are you a popular item, or are you beginning to gather dust on the shelf? If you get even the vaguest sense that there is an imaginary "do not enter" sign outside your office, you've just become a little smarter about what you must change. When the issue is negativity, I prefer this form of observational feedback to mere monitoring of speech patterns. Checking what you say doesn't automatically tell you what other people think of you. You may be overly negative, but your colleagues may be capable of living with it. But seeing how people relate to you provides proof that your flaw is serious, that it matters to people, that it's a problem. Chapter 4, Part 2, The 20 Habits. Habit number 9, withholding information. In the age of knowledge workers, the cliche that information is power is truer than ever, which makes withholding information even more extreme and irritating. Intentionally withholding information is the opposite of adding value. We are deleting value. Yet, it has the same purpose, to gain power. It's the same old need to win, only more devious, and it appears in more forms than merely playing our cards close to our vest. You see it in people who are exaggerating the virtue of keeping a secret. They use it as an excuse to leave you out of the information flow. You see it in people who answer every question with a question. They believe revealing anything puts them at a disadvantage. You see it in its passive-aggressive incarnation to people who don't return your phone calls or answer your emails or only give partial answers to your queries. If you don't understand why it annoys people, reflect on how you felt about the following events. A meeting you weren't told about. A memo or email you weren't copied on. A moment when you were the last person to learn something. The problem with not sharing, for whatever reason, is that it rarely achieves the desired effect. You may think you're gaining an edge in consolidating power, but you're actually breeding mistrust. In order to have power, you need to inspire loyalty rather than fear and suspicion. Withholding information is nothing more than a misplaced need to win. What I'm describing here is not just the willful, poison-sowing refusal to share information, the way people behave when they want to divide and conquer. I'm not sure I have the skill or patience to alter that Machiavellian behavior. What I'd prefer to focus on are all the unintentional or accidental ways we withhold information. We do this when we're too busy to get back to someone with valuable information. We do this when we forget to include someone in our discussions or meetings. We do this when we delegate a task to our subordinate, but don't take the time to show them exactly how we want the task done. One of my neighbors asked his teenage son to wash his Lexus SUV. The son pulled out the water hose, filled the bucket with soapy water, and went to work with the sponge. Problem was, the sponge was one of those two-sided designs, one side scratchy, the other soft. By the time the father came out to inspect the results, the son had scrubbed away a good deal of the Lexus shiny enamel finish. The Lexus's once gleaming surface looked like an ice skating rink after a hockey game. The father was enraged. His Lexus was ruined. How could his son be so stupid? "Don't you know how to do something as simple as washing a car?" he asked between snorts of rage. But as my neighbor thought about it, and as he saw that his son was embarrassed and upset, he said something wise. "Son, I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at myself, because I should have told you how to do this job properly. I never taught you how to wash a car, and that's my fault." Whatever tension hovered over that scene in the family driveway at that moment instantly disappeared when my neighbor realized that he had left some vital information out of his son's basic education. The son felt relieved. The father was no longer upset, either at his son or at the sorry condition of his Lexus. It's now a running family joke whenever someone sees a sponge. More often than not, we don't withhold information out of malice. We do it because we're clueless. That's a good thing. Willful maliciousness is not a flaw that we can fix here, but cluelessness is easy to change. I was advising a friend who was having trouble with his assistant. They weren't meshing as a team, he told me, but he didn't know why or how to fix the problem. All he had to go on was a vague feeling that our timing is off. Before I talked to his assistant, I asked him, "What would your assistant say is your biggest flaw as a boss?" "That I don't communicate enough with her," he answered. "I don't share information. I leave her out of the loop." "Anything else?" I inquired. "No, that's it," he said. "Isn't that enough?" "Do you think she's right?" I asked. "Yes." Interesting, I thought. You don't hear too many bosses taking all the blame for some interpersonal dysfunction. Then I asked the assistant why they didn't mesh. She agreed. Her boss didn't share information well. Because he was a friend and I was helping him pro bono, I did something I don't normally do. I pretended to be a consumer researcher who tracks how people use a company's product all day. In this case, I tagged along with him from the moment he walked into work and observed his behavior with his assistant until he left work. What I saw explained everything. He arrived at the office about 15 minutes before his assistant. The first thing he did was check his emails. Then his cell phone rang and he answered it. During this conversation, his assistant arrived at her desk. She poked her head in to say good morning. He waved while still talking. When he ended the call, he turned to his computer screen and jotted down some notes and answered a few emails. His assistant popped in to say that one of his accountants was on the line. Did he want to take that call? He did. Three other calls came in during his 20-minute conversation. When he hung up, he returned those calls, all the while scanning his computer for incoming emails. This pattern continued all morning. By noon, I had seen enough. "Is this what it's like around here every day?" I asked. "Pretty much," he said. My friend, indeed, was guilty of keeping his assistant in the dark. But he wasn't doing so maliciously, or for that matter, intentionally. His work life was like a haphazard fire drill. He was so distracted, so disorganized, so busy responding to calls and putting out fires, that he never had time to sit down with his assistant for a daily briefing. If he had, I suspect it would have solved their information sharing issue. I also suspect that's a big reason why so many of us withhold information. It's not that we want to keep people in the dark. It's simply that we're too busy. We mean well. We have good intentions, but we fail to get around to it. As a result, we become bad at sharing information, whether it comes in the form of a news bulletin or a heads up or instruction that teaches people how to do something that we don't have time to do ourselves. Over time, it begins to look like we are withholding information. Being bad at sharing information doesn't mean we are willfully withholding it. The two are not exactly the same thing, but the net result is the same in the eyes of the people around us. How do you stop withholding information? Simple answer. Start sharing it. That's what my friend did. He made sharing information a higher priority in his busy day. He scheduled time to debrief with his assistant on what he was up to, and he made that time inviolate. It couldn't be canceled or postponed or interrupted by a phone call. If this is your issue, I advise the same solution. In doing so, you will not only improve your communication, but you'll be proving that you care about your coworkers, demonstrating that what they think matters to you. It's not often that we get such an obvious two-for-the-price-of-one solution to our interpersonal challenges, but making the subtle shift from withholding to sharing information is one of them. Habit 10. Failing to give proper recognition. This is a sibling of withholding information. In withholding your recognition of another person's contribution to a team's success, you are not only sowing injustice and treating people unfairly, but you are depriving people of the emotional payoff that comes with success. They cannot revel in the success or accept congratulations because you have choked off that option. Instead, they feel forgotten, ignored, pushed to the side, and they resent you for it. If you really want to tick people off, don't recognize their contributions. In depriving people of recognition, you are depriving them of closure, and we all need closure in any interpersonal transaction. Closure comes in many forms, from the emotional complexity of paying our last respects to loved ones before they die, to something as pro forma as saying, "You're welcome," when someone else says thank you. Either way, we expect closure. Recognition is all about closure. It's the beautiful ribbon wrapped around the jewel box that contains the precious gift of success you and your team have created. When you fail to provide that recognition, you are cheapening the gift. You have the success, but none of the afterglow. This happens at work and at home. In training programs, when I ask participants, how many of you think you need to do a better job of recognizing others for their great work? Without fail, 8 out of 10 people raise their hands. When I ask them why they fail at recognition, the answers say more about the people responding than the people who aren't being recognized. I just get too busy. I just expected everyone to do great work. I never realized how important it was to them. I was never recognized for my great work. Why should they be? Note the aggressive use of the first-person singular pronoun. It's a hallmark of successful people. They became great achievers because of their intense focus on themselves, their career, their performance, their progress, their needs. But there's a difference between being an achiever and a leader. Successful people become great leaders when they learn to shift the focus from themselves to others. One of my clients taught me a wonderful technique for improving in the area of providing recognition. 1. He first made a list of all the important groups of people in his life, friends, family, direct reports, consumers, etc. 2. He then wrote down the names of every important person in each group. 3. Twice a week on Wednesday morning and Friday afternoon, he would review the list of names and ask himself, did someone on this page do something that I should recognize? 4. If the answer was yes, he gave them some small, very quick recognition, either by phone, email, voicemail, or a note. If the answer was no, he did nothing. He didn't want to be a phony. Within 1 year, this executive's reputation for providing positive recognition improved from poor to excellent. He was amazed at how little time this took. Of all the interpersonal slights we make in our professional or private lives, not providing recognition may be one that endures most deeply in the minds of the slighted, except for habit number 11, claiming credit that we don't deserve. Claiming credit is adding insult to the injury that comes with overlooked recognition. We're not only depriving people of the credit they deserve, but we are hogging it for ourselves. It's two crimes in one. Imagine those moments in your life, whether as a school kid or as an adult in the workplace, when you did something wonderful and waited for the praise and congratulations. And waited. And waited. It happens all the time. The world isn't always paying attention when we excel. People have their own agendas to pursue. If it happens when we're kids, we sulk and whimper about being overlooked. It's not fair, we whine. But as we mature, we learn to handle the neglect. It's the way of the world, we tell ourselves. It doesn't alter the fact that we did something special, even if we're the only ones to know it. We move on to something else. But even the most highly evolved human being would have a tough time grinning and bearing when neglect turns to larceny. That's what it is when someone claims credit that they do not deserve. Theft. That's as if they're stealing our ideas, our performances, our self-esteem, our life. We didn't like it when it happened to us as children, and the stakes generally involved little more than our teacher's approval. But we actively hate it when it happens to us as adults, in part because the stakes in terms of our careers and financial rewards are so much greater. When someone you work with steals the credit for a success that you created, they're committing the most rage-inducing interpersonal crime in the workplace. This is the interpersonal flaw that generates more negative emotion than any other in my feedback interviews, and it creates a bitterness that's hard to forget. You can forgive someone for not recognizing your stellar performance. You can't forgive that person for recognizing it and brazenly claiming it as his or her own. If it's happened to you, you know how hard it is to shed that bitter taste. Now, turn the tables. Imagine you're the perpetrator rather than the victim. If you look closely, you'll see that claiming credit that we don't deserve is another sibling of the need to win. You wouldn't claim someone else's resume or college degree as your own. That's because those achievements are well documented. Your claim can be challenged. But when it comes to determining exactly who came up with the winning phrase in the meeting, or who held together an important client relationship during a rocky phase, the evidence gets fuzzy. It's hard to say who deserves the credit. So given the choice between grasping the credit for ourselves or leaving it for someone else to claim, we fall into the success traps described in Chapter 3. I can succeed. I will succeed. I have succeeded. I chose to succeed. And give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. We claim more credit than we have earned and slowly begin to believe it. In the meantime, the victims of our injustice are seething. If you know how you feel as a victim, you should know how people feel about you for doing the same. It's not a pretty picture, is it? There's no telling what a group can achieve when no one cares who gets the credit. We know this in our bones. We know it because we remember how good we felt about our colleagues when they accorded us the credit we deserved. So why don't we reciprocate when someone else deserves the credit? I don't have an answer for that. Even if we can legitimately blame our parents or our upbringing or some petty slight in high school for our credit hogging, that doesn't begin to solve the problem. It's focusing on the past, which we cannot change, rather than arming ourselves with concrete, actionable ideas for the future. The best way to stop being a credit hog is to do the opposite. Share the wealth. Here's a simple drill that will transform you from a credit miser to a credit philanthropist. For one day, or longer if you can handle it, make a mental note of every time you privately congratulate yourself on an achievement, large or small. Then write it down. If you're like me, you'll find that you pat yourself on the back more often than you think during a day. For everything from coming up with a big idea for a client, to showing up on time for a meeting, to dashing off a clever note to a colleague. We think as we survey our beautiful handiwork, we did good. There's nothing wrong with these private thoughts. The pleasure that we take in our own performance is what keeps us merrily motivated as we chug our way through a long, arduous day. I wouldn't be surprised if one day yielded 24 episodes of self-congratulation for each of us. Once you've assembled the list, take apart each episode and ask yourself if it's in any way possible that someone else might deserve the credit for your achievement. If you showed up on time for a meeting across town, is it because you are heroically punctual and thoughtful? Or was it because your assistant hounded you that morning about the meeting and actually chased you off a phone call and made sure you were out the door to get across town in sufficient time? If you came up with a good idea in a meeting, did it spring unbidden from your fertile imagination? Or was it inspired by an insightful comment from someone else in the room? As you go through your list, consider this make or break question. If any of the other people involved in your episodes were looking at the situation, would they accord you as much credit as you are claiming for yourself? Or would they hand it out to someone else, perhaps even themselves? It's possible as you review your list that you conclude you deserve all the credit. But I doubt even the most self-involved among us would see things this myopically. We have a strong bias to remember events in a light most favorable to us. This drill exposes that bias and makes us consider the possibility that someone else's perspective is closer to the truth. Habit 12. Making excuses. When Bill Clinton published his best-selling memoir in 2004, he knew he would have to deal with the Monica Lewinsky scandal during his second term. He did so by explaining it as a personal failure, a yielding to private demons. Once people reach the age of accountability, no matter what people do to them, he said, that is not an excuse for any mistakes they make. On the other hand, one does seek to understand why he or she makes the mistakes they make. I was involved in two great struggles at the same time. A great public struggle over the future of America with the Republican Congress, and a private struggle with my old demons. I won the public one and lost the private one. I don't think it's much more complicated than that. That's not an excuse, but it's an explanation, and that's the best I can do. Bill Clinton understood the distinction. And not just because his behavior was inexcusable. There simply is no excuse for making excuses. When you hear yourself saying, "I'm sorry, I'm late, but the traffic was murder," stop talking at the word sorry. Blaming the traffic is a lame excuse and doesn't excuse the fact that you kept people waiting. You should have started earlier. What's the worst that could happen? You arrive ahead of schedule and have to wait a few minutes in the lobby? Are you really worried about having to say, "I'm sorry I'm early, but I left too soon, and the traffic was nowhere near as bad as I anticipated"? If the world worked like that, there would be no excuses. I like to divide excuses into two categories, blunt and subtle. The blunt, "dog ate my homework" excuse sounds like this. "I'm sorry I missed our lunch date. My assistant had it marked down for the wrong day on my calendar." Message: see, it's not that I forgot the lunch date. It's not that I don't regard you as important. So important that lunch with you is the unchangeable, non-negotiable highlight of my day. It's simply that my assistant is inept. Blame my assistant, not me. The problem with this type of excuse is that we rarely get away with it, and it's hardly an effective leadership strategy. After reviewing thousands of 360-degree feedback summaries, I have a feel for what direct reports respect and don't respect in their leaders. I have never seen feedback that said, "I think you are a great leader because I love the quality of your excuses," or, "I thought you were messing up, but you turned me around when you made those excuses." The more subtle excuses appear when we attribute our failings to some inherited DNA that is permanently lodged within us. We talk about ourselves as if we have permanent genetic flaws that can never be altered. You've surely heard these excuses. Maybe you've used them to describe yourself. "I'm impatient. I always put things off to the last minute. I've always had a quick temper. I am horrendous at time management. I've been told for years by my coworkers and spouse that I waste time on pointless projects and discussions. I guess that's just the way I am." It's amazing how often I hear otherwise brilliant, successful people make willfully self-deprecating comments about themselves. It's a subtle art, because in effect, they are stereotyping themselves as impatient or hot-tempered or disorganized, and using that stereotype to excuse otherwise inexcusable behavior. Our personal stereotyping may have its origins in stories that have been repeated for years, often from as far back as childhood. These stories may have no basis in fact, but they imprint themselves on our brains and establish low expectations that become self-fulfilling prophecies. We behave as if we wanted to prove that our negative expectations were correct. I'm a good example of this. Growing up in Valley Station, Kentucky, I might naturally have become involved in cars, tools, and mechanical things. My dad owned a two-pump gas station. Many of my friends liked to work on cars and race them on Saturday nights at the drag strip. As a child, however, I gained a different set of expectations from my mother. Almost from birth, she told me, "Marshall, you are extremely smart. In fact, you are the smartest little boy in Valley Station." She told me that I wasn't just going to college, I could go to graduate school. She also said, "Marshall, you have no mechanical skills, and you will never have any mechanical skills for the rest of your life." I think this was her way of making sure I wouldn't pump gas and change tires at the service station. It's interesting how my mother's imprinting and expectations affected my development. I was never encouraged to work on cars or to be around tools. As a teenager in the 1960s, I thought a universal joint was something that hippies smoked. Not only did my parents assume that I had no mechanical skills, my friends knew it too. When I was 18 years old, I took the U.S. Army's mechanical aptitude test and scored at the bottom second percentile of the entire nation. So it was true. 6 years later, however, I was at UCLA working on my PhD. One of my professors asked me to write down things I did well and things I couldn't do. On the positive side, I jotted down research and writing and analysis and speaking, which was a not-so-subtle way of writing, "I am smart." On the negative side, I wrote, "I have no mechanical skills. I will never have any mechanical skills." The professor asked me how I knew I had no mechanical skills. I explained my life history and told him about my dismal showing on the Army test. "How are your mathematical skills?" he asked. I proudly replied that I had scored a perfect 800 on the SAT Math 1 achievement test. He then asked, "Why is it that you can solve complex mathematical problems, but you can't solve simple mechanical problems?" Then he asked, "How is your hand-eye coordination?" I said that I was good at pinball and had helped pay my college expenses by shooting pool, so I guessed that it was fine. He asked, "Why is it that you can shoot pool, but you can't hammer nails?" That's when I realized that I did not suffer from a genetic defect. I was just living out the expectations that I had chosen to believe. At that point, I was old enough to know better. It was no longer just my family and friends reinforcing my belief that I was mechanically hopeless. And it wasn't the army test either. I was the one who kept telling myself, "You can't do this." I realized that as long as I kept saying that, it was going to be true. Next time you hear yourself saying, "I'm just no good at," ask yourself, "Why not?" This doesn't just refer to our aptitudes at mathematics or mechanics. It also applies to our behavior. We excuse our tardiness because we've been running late all our lives, and our parents and friends let us get away with it. The same with any of the other annoying habits we've been describing. Passing judgment, making destructive comments, refusing to share information. These are not genetic flaws. You weren't born that way, no matter what we've been brought up to believe. Likewise, the next time you hear one of your coworkers try to worm their way out of accepting responsibility by saying, "I'm just no good at it," ask them, "Why not?" If we can stop excusing ourselves, we can get better at almost anything we choose. Habit 13. Clinging to the past. There is a school of thought among psychologists and behavioral consultants that we can understand a lot about our errant behavior by delving into our past, particularly our family dynamics. This is the school that believes when it's hysterical, it's historical. If you're a perfectionist or constant approval seeker, it's because your parents never said you were good enough. If you operate above the rules and feel you can do no wrong, it's because your parents doted on you and inflated your importance. If you freeze around authority figures, it's because you had a controlling mother, and so on. That school is on permanent recess here. I don't have much patience with therapy that clings to the past, because going backwards is not about creating change. It's about understanding. One of my earliest clients used to spend hours telling me, "Marshall, you don't understand. Let me explain why I have these issues. Let me explain my mother and father." It was one long, unendurable whine. Finally, I reached into my pocket for a coin and said, "Here's a quarter. Call someone who cares." Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with understanding. Understanding the past is perfectly admissible if your issue is accepting the past. But if your issue is changing the future, understanding will not take you there. My experience tells me that the only effective approach is looking people in the eye and saying, "If you want to change, do this." But even with the blunt talk, clients who cling to the past, who want to understand why they are the way they are, remain my toughest assignments. It takes me a long time to convince them that they can't do anything about the past. They can't change it or rewrite it or make excuses for it. All they can do is accept it and move on. But for some reason, many people enjoy living in the past, especially if going back there lets them blame someone else for anything that's gone wrong in their lives. That's when clinging to the past becomes an interpersonal problem. We use the past as a weapon against others. We also cling to the past as a way of contrasting it with the present, usually to highlight something positive about ourselves at the expense of someone else. Do you ever find yourself beginning a long self-serving story with the phrase, "When I was your age"? What's really going on here? When we make excuses, we are blaming someone or something beyond our control as the reason for our failure. Anyone but ourselves. But sometimes we blame other people not as an excuse for our failure, but as a subtle way of highlighting our successes. It's no more attractive than making excuses, but we usually require a really smart person whom we love to point it out to us. I learned this from my daughter Kelly. When she was 7 years old, we were living in a nice house in San Diego, still my home. One day, annoyed over a professional setback, I came home and took out my annoyance on Kelly. I trotted out the sorriest, most pathetic speech any parent can give a child, the one that begins, "When I was your age." Inevitably, it's a self-pitying lecture that points out how difficult and miserable the parent's childhood was in comparison with the childhood the parent is now providing for his or her children. I started yammering about growing up in Kentucky in a gas station and how we didn't have money and how hard I had to work to become the first person in my family to graduate from college. contrasting this, of course, with all the wonderful things Kelly had. She patiently listened to my diatribe, instinctively letting me vent. When I finished, she said, "Daddy, it's not my fault you make money." That stopped me in my tracks. I realized she's right. How could I expect her to know what it's like to be poor when I was damn sure she never would be? I chose to work hard and make money. She didn't. In effect, I was bragging about how hard I had it and how clever I was to have triumphed over such adversity, and masking that boasting by dumping my frustrations on her. Fortunately, she called me on it. Stop blaming others for the choices you made. And that goes with double emphasis for the choices that turned out well. Habit 14. Playing favorites. I have reviewed custom-designed leadership profiles at more than 100 major corporations. It's my job to rewrite them. These documents typically feature boilerplate language that describes the leadership behavior each company desires. Such chestnuts include: communicates a clear vision, helps people to develop at their maximum potential, strives to see the value of differing opinions, and avoids playing favorites. Not one profile has ever included the desired behavior that read, "effectively sucks up to management." Although given the dedication to fawning and sucking up in most corporations, and how often such behavior is rewarded, it probably should. While almost every company says it wants people to challenge the system and to be empowered to express your opinion and say what you really think, there sure are a lot of performers who are stuck on sucking up. Not only do companies say they abhor such comically servile behavior, but so do individual leaders. Almost all the leaders I have met say that they would never encourage such a thing in their organizations. I have no doubt that they are sincere. Most of us are easily irritated, if not disgusted, by derriere kissers. Which raises a question. If leaders say they discourage sucking up, why does it dominate the workplace? Keep in mind that these leaders are generally very shrewd judges of character. They spend their lives sizing up people, taking in first impressions and recalibrating them against later impressions. And yet, they still fall for the super skilled suck up. They still play favorites. The simple answer is, we can't see in ourselves what we can see so clearly in others. Perhaps you are thinking now, it's amazing how leaders send out subtle signals that encourage subordinates to mute their criticisms and exaggerate their praise of the powers that be. And it is so surprising how they cannot see it in themselves. Of course, this doesn't apply to me. Maybe you're right. But how can you be so sure you're not in denial? I use an irrefutable test with my clients to show how we all unknowingly encourage sucking up. I ask a group of leaders, how many of you own a dog that you love? Big smiles come across the executive's face as they wave their hands in the air. They beam as they tell me the names of their always faithful hounds. Then we have a contest. I ask them, at home, who gets most of your unabashed affection? Is it A, your husband, wife, or partner, B, your kids, or C, your dog? More than 80% of the time, the winner is the dog. I then ask the executives if they love their dog more than their family members. The answer is always a predictable but resounding no. My follow-up: so why does the dog get most of your attention? Their replies all sound the same. The dog is always happy to see me. The dog never talks back. The dog gives me unconditional love no matter what I do. In other words, the dog is a suck-up. I can't say that I'm any better. I love my dog, Bo. I travel at least 180 days a year, and Bo goes bonkers when I return home from a trip. I pull into the driveway, and my first inclination is to open the front door, go straight to Bo and exclaim, "Daddy's home!" Invariably, Bo jumps up and down, and I hug him and pat him and make a huge fuss over him. One day, my daughter Kelly was home from college. She watched my typical love fest with Bo. She then looked at me, held her hands in the air like little paws, and barked, "Woof, woof!" Point taken. If we aren't careful, we can wind up treating people at work like dogs, rewarding those who heap unthinking, unconditional admiration upon us. What behavior do we get in return? A virulent case of the suck-up.